is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian.
In this hour, Turkey's election
returned President Erdogan to power despite the crises in the country. How did he win? And what does his re-election mean for Turkish democracy?
Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Last month, Turkey concluded a second round of elections for its president. And in a surprise, based on polling and the political and economic conditions of the nation, its president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, won re-election with 52% of the vote. This is despite a rather high inflation rate, criticisms of the government's response to the earthquake, whose damage was seemingly exacerbated by a lax building code that Erdogan had championed, and fears that a growing authoritarianism could signal the end of Turkish democracy. So on today's show, we will discuss the Turkish election and its impact on the nation and the region. Our panel today is Serhan Al. He is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at İzmir University of Economics in Turkey. He's also currently a visiting professor at Ohio State University. He's the author of An Anatomy of Nationhood and a Question of Assimilation, Debates on Turkishness Revisited, Human Security versus National Security, Kurds, Turkey, and Syrian Rojava, and Is Turkey Ready for a Post-Erdogan Era? Roadblocks to a Democratic Transition. And Hamut Sali, he's professor of political science and associate dean of international education at California State University, Dominguez Hills. He is a regular commentator for Arab media and is a host of SWANA Region Radio. Thank you both very, very much for joining us. And Professor Al, I'll ask you first question, which is all the polling and all the reporting suggested that Erdogan was likely going to lose. He didn't. What happened?
Thanks for having me. So yeah, I mean, the expectation was that the opposition would win. Most of the polls showed Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who was the opposition leader under the Nation Alliance. The polls showed that he was leading against Erdogan, despite criticisms by many scholars that he was the weakest candidate against Erdogan, because there were other potential candidates, such as mayor of Istanbul, Ekrem İmamoğlu, who is a charismatic and, you know, touched the people on the street. He can really connect with the people well, as opposed to Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. So a lot of scholars, you know, pointed him as a good candidate who can win against Erdogan. But despite this view, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, and to be honest, he was the engineer behind bringing all the opposition together in Nation Alliance. There was the, you know, the Republican People's Party and other Good Party or E Party, Nationals Party, couple of, you know, political Islamist background, ex-Erdogan supporters party as well, such as, you know, Davutoğlu Babacan. So Kılıçdaroğlu was the engineer behind, you know, uniting the opposition against Erdogan, except the Kurds. The Kurds, you know, had a different alliance called Labor and Freedom Alliance. So all the odds show that, you know, the opposition would be close to a victory against Erdogan, because economy is not doing great. As you mentioned, earthquake, catastrophe, really the government mismanaged the relief efforts in the first couple of days. And Turkey is basically far from a democracy, right? A lot of scholars define Turkey as a competitive authoritarian state. So we should definitely remember that this election was not done under completely free and fair conditions. Erdogan rules the government for more than 20 years now. He controls the state resources. The media is predominantly close to Erdogan. Major business circles are close to Erdogan. Judiciary, right, especially the cases against the Kurdish activists, Kurdish politicians recently in recent years, definitely weakened the opposition. But still, This was one of his weakest moments when you consider the last two decades, particularly considering the economy. The inflation is hit, like official numbers hit 80% last year. Now the numbers show that it's declining, but a lot of people argue that on the streets, the feeling of inflation is definitely more than 100%. Turkish lira is depreciating against dollar significantly. So people definitely became poorer in the last couple of years. So all the odds were against Erdogan, but despite this, he won. Yes, the elections are not free and fair, but still Erdogan is a very popular guy among his constituencies. He really, in his first decade, he invested in infrastructure. He really kind of gave identity, self-confidence to some of the pious Muslim communities in Turkey who felt excluded from the secular Republican regime, you know, in the 1980s, in the 1990s. Headscarf issue was a big issue in the 1990s. The headscarf was banned from the public spaces, basically the parliament, the universities. So that's kind of a trauma in the pious Muslim communities with regards to the secular Republican regime. So Erdogan kind of gave them confidence, identity, inclusion in his, you know, predominantly conservative, pious rule. So what do you do? This is an interesting question and challenge for political scientists. What do you do when autocrats are supported by people? So this is definitely a case for Erdogan. He has become significantly autocratic in the last decade or so, but despite that, his constituencies, his people definitely continue to support him, despite some even are not comfortable with the economy, some, you know, complaining about the economy. Despite that, they still believe that, yes, Erdogan can still solve our problems. But they don't want to see that, you know, some of the causes of these problems is Erdogan himself, right? So there's a significant criticism even among the Erdogan supporters, but people did not want to give up on Erdogan because of the belief that, you know, he would solve those economic problems. And also we need to remember that, you know, probably we are going to talk about it. We live today in a multipolar world with a lot of uncertainties. The Russian invasion of Ukraine, China is on the rise. United States doesn't seem as strong as it used to be. NATO is in a way struggling against Russia. So people in Turkey, definitely Syria, definitely the Syrian civil war, right next to Turkey in the southern border. People definitely want to see a strong leader in this time of uncertainty. So I think this was one of the advantages of Erdogan, because his all narrative campaigning was that he has been a strong leader of Turkey and he has a say in global politics. You know, considering the Ukrainian-Russian conflict, Erdogan played a role. Yes. Erdogan can stop Sweden from becoming a member of NATO. So this gives an image that, you know, Erdogan is a strong leader in world politics. And some of his supporters buy this argument, right? They see him as a strong leader. So this helped him a lot, I think. That was one of the disadvantages of the opposition leader, Kılıçdaroğlu. Despite his honesty, his supporters loved him. He couldn't give an image that he would be a strong leader in these times of uncertainties in world politics.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's a lot there in your answer that we're going to delve into. But one of the first things that comes to mind is this big, broad political science question about identity and motion versus the kind of rational economic approach that certainly seemed to play out here in Turkey. Hamut Salih, I want to bring you in. I know In the West, there seems to be at least some degree, if not a significant degree, of hand-wringing in a sense of this was an opportunity wasted, the ability to defeat Erdogan. Is that true in the region? Has the region welcomed Erdogan's re-election, or are they concerned at all about his re-election?
The vast majority of the region, Swana region, maybe excluding, there were some divisions in India. I mean, the vast majority of the region, particularly the Arab world, wanted Erdogan to win. And I'll tell you why. Dr. Serhan, good analysis on Erdogan. But I think, to emphasize that point, this was an election that the West somehow got it lost. To a large degree, Erdogan didn't win the election despite the numbers. It's the opposition that lost it. And I'll tell you from the start, the opposition leader, Kemal, is an old veteran, has been in power for so many years. He's visible. Also ran many elections, failed. Lack of charisma. It's the same. So when you talk about change, you have the old sort of message. And it reminded me so much of the German elections between when Schröder took power after Helmut Kohl was in charge. And he was sort of, there was a generation who didn't even know about him. So when Schröder ran, Schröder would be like the version, as you may know, of Donald Trump today. He had no plan, and basically he was a big sort of advocate using controversial issues. But he won the election because people got tired of Helmut Kohl. And when you look at the statistics at the time, unemployment was always a significant factor in German election, which was, if it is below a certain number, I think it's 4%, chances are the Germans will elect the incumbent. Well, Helmut Kohl was below that. He was that successful economically, but he lost. In the case when you bring to Turkey, you have the leadership one is a problem. Then the failure to underscore or to bring a message of an economic change. It was more, you know, vote for me. I am better. I'll make your life better, but there was no real problem. Part of it is that the coalition that the challengers of the opposition formed was so divided. It had one single goal, which is to defeat Erdogan. But internally, there were major differences. The only thing that got them together is let's defeat Erdogan. So that's the second one, is that the lack of clear taking advantage of the economic conditions in favor of to rally the support. Then there is the issue of the earthquake. If you look at the poll prior to the earthquake, the economy in Turkey was actually getting better and better. There were no significant candidates at that time that would challenge, seen as challenging Erdogan. The earthquake for a moment there changed the whole game. Now, the emphasis on the failure to implement policy, corruptions, all of that. What does Erdogan come in and say? You know, this is an act of God. We didn't know. It resonates well with the population. The challenge for the opposition was not able to make the earthquake an issue. In fact, in the election, the earthquake was not an issue. And to the contrary, it worked in favor of Erdogan because he had a plan. He already initiated this policy at the last minute, a lot of money there. And the argument is that if you get somebody else, you might not get what you are getting. Then there are some issues, the issue of refugees, particularly in the second time. But this is a humanitarian issue. It's an issue that involves, the European Union. It's a very serious, complicated issue. And then remember, you have children of the refugees who were born in Turkey. So we're talking about this is 2011, 2012. In addition, you have refugee citizens who were refugees become citizens. But it's singled out to, you know, even the terminology used, the Syrians, and it was an issue in the second round. Now, add to that, there are something that changes in the Turkish society, and Dr. Serhan may have a different position, but I feel like the Turkish, what they have been able to, Erdogan has been able to do, is despite what we think today, polarization in the Turkish society, but there are some defining moment or factors that these are what characterize the Turks. For example, the flag is so popular in all Turkey. It's the symbol of the nation. Everybody raises it. But there is the issue of identity. I think the Turkish move to the idea that we are more East than West, meaning that the new generation sees itself as modern, but also Islamist or Islam, whatever you want to use it. Meaning that the borderline is that it's what typical Muslims do. They are Muslims because you're born as a Muslim. You know, you go and have, you know, commit, drink or do whatever you do on regular days. And then Friday comes, go and pray. And you tell yourself, it's a matter of points. I'm praying, I get 15 points from God. I did whatever I did bad, so that deduction. In other words, there is a settled idea that identity issue is no longer defining. It's a serious issue for the Kurds. It's a serious issue perhaps for the issues of Syrian, particularly its connection to the whole conflict in Syria. But Islamist, modernist is what characterized the Turkey. If we go on the other side, very briefly, Douglas, you have number one, Erdogan in both instances ran on his achievements. The challenge that he was facing, and you could see it's corrected in the second round, was the ability to connect with the youth. So, and you have about five, I mean, numbers vary. I mean, we thought 4 million of youth eligible to vote, and then some numbers are 7 million, whatever. So you have at least 5 million of the young generation eligible to vote. They were not able to reach to them as much in the first round. But in the second round, what you have a huge media campaign. There was not a single day during the 2 weeks of the election for the second round where there was not a Twitter sent to the youth specifically. This is regardless of the fact that the AKP, the party, has strong roots in the Turkish society, in the universities, and the youth organize, helps promote the party. They are very, very sort of active. And this is part of, when you look at Erdogan past, he was the youngest person to be elected to a provincial party representative as the age 27, which created a lot of problems at that time for other parties who had shifted to that. So yeah, Erdogan was able to connect. The other thing that was really that the opposition doesn't have, and Dr. Serhan had it very clearly, the control of the media. I mean, if you watch the RTT, the Turkish television in Arabic, I watched the whole time the election was following minute by minute. You could very clearly see that the message is not to report, you know, they were more worried about what if Erdogan loses, what's going to happen to us, because they are a pro-media. There were several studies where, you know, and it's easy, you could see it, that the focus is more on Erdogan than the opposition, which is really, this is, we see it everywhere. I mean, the incumbent has the advantage of that. But related to that, to connect it to that, is that also the image that Erdogan presented, he connected with the people. He had pictures on YouTube, on TV showing him as a father. You know, there is this girl that was crying to meet him. He arranged to meet her. All of these are very, very important. And the last point, I'm sorry this is taking long, Dr. Douglas, but the last point is that Serhan talks about the businesses. What was really interesting is that in the big cities, Izmir, Istanbul, and Ankara, he lost them twice. But he was able to win enough in the second round to be the difference. And the reason he lost them, because the culture, what I call the culture of the political parties in Turkey, there is the person who is in charge of the mayor or the mayor, or the party who is in power, has great influence in establishing, giving perks, privileges to the businesses. They left when the party lost these big cities, They lost that connection with the business. But where he gets it, he gets it somewhere else in the countryside where there is a lot of support. He gets also on in areas where, I mean, he visited this city on the borders of Syria, close to Idlib, where they voted 90% for the opposition. They are Alawite, which is Shia, another sort of Islamic denomination, so different from his. He won that city because that week he opened a hospital for that city. So he had the power, the resources that he invested in the city by projecting himself as a leader who will make a difference and to be trusted. And because the opposition, again, to get back to the original point, the opposition lasted, they did not have an alternative, a viable candidate, and a serious plan to change Turkey to the right direction. Their plan, the emphasis on that, to lean toward Europe, going back, applying to the European Union, criticizing Turkey's about NATO, that also it's old story. I mean, the data there, maybe I'm wrong, but the perception is that that's not a relevant issue to sort of improve their conditions, to better condition the Turkish people. Mm. Yeah.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the recent Turkish elections, the re-election of President Erdogan, with Serhan Al of İzmir University of Economics in Turkey and Hamut Salih of California State University, Dominguez Hills. Serhan, I wanted to delve into something that Hamut just said. There's, you know, a lot out there, and I really wanted to kind of push on this, that this notion of sort of secularism versus Islam within Turkey. I know that historically, secularism tied obviously to the founding of the modern state, tied to Ataturk, a Kemalist policy is always as it gets described. And it's very much tied to Turkey's perception of itself as being European, you know, kind of modern European, versus a rejection of that and a calling for a greater role that Islam would play within Turkish politics, which I would imagine would be turning its back a bit on Europe. That's been a huge issue in Turkey, really, ever since the founding of the state. Is this election a signal, as I mean, Hamut suggested, that really, the signal is that Turkey does not see itself as European any longer, doesn't see itself as being secular, though the vote was rather close. How did that issue play in this election?
Definitely, historically, the Turkish Republic, you know, was founded on the idea of secularism, right? Or what we call laïcité, following the French version, that, you know, separation of state and church, but also the state would be in charge of defining the religion, right? So we are talking about, that's how Diyanet, the Directorate of Religious Affairs, functioned throughout Turkey, that the state would be in charge of the religion rather than leaving to autonomous networks, autonomous tariqats, or autonomous religious communities. So that's definitely one of the defining historical issues and polarizing issues in Turkey, right? In modern Turkey, and definitely in this election, that played a role as well. If you look at the coalition of Erdogan, right? His coalition, the People's Alliance, you can see a couple of Islamist parties, for instance, New Welfare Party, led by Fatih Erbakan, who is the son of the famous Necmettin Erbakan, who was the leader of the political Islam in the 1970s, 80s. He was kind of the teacher of Erdogan, right? Erdogan was the mayor of Istanbul in the 1990s from the Welfare Party. So the New Welfare Party, Fatih Erbakan, supported Erdogan. Hüdapar, which is, you know, usually called as Kurdish Hizbullah, right? Kurdish or Turkish Hizbullah, coming from definitely an Islamist background, they supported Erdogan as well. The Nationalist Action Party, they are not necessarily Islamist, but they are considered as a right-wing nationalist group. So they all supported Erdogan. And What we see is that from this alliance, we see the embodiment of Turkish Islamic synthesis, right? Not necessarily the secular Turkish state, but a state that defines itself with a more Turkish and Islamic codes. Or we can definitely frame it in a way that, as some scholars recently argued, a neo-Ottoman image of the state, that there is this imperial nostalgia that Turkey should become like an Ottoman Empire again in world politics, with its military power, with its, you know, Islamic character, religious character, etc. So definitely we are seeing a tone from Erdogan and his coalition, an image of a Turkish Islamic synthesis and also neo-Ottoman imperial nostalgia. On the other hand, the opposition, they are definitely representing a more secular version of society in Turkey. I mean, CHP, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu's party, founder of modern Turkey, definitely based on secular Turkish codes. E Party, it's a nationalist party, but it is a secular, mostly a secular, more urban nationalist party. Also the Kurdish party, the pro-Kurdish party, I mean HDP, or they entered the elections with a new banner called Green Left Party. They are definitely emphasizing secularism more than the Islamic identity. So it wouldn't be wrong to, you know, say that this election was kind of a competition between those who embrace a more pious Muslim identity versus a more secular European identity. But also, we cannot really reduce the society into this white and black groups, right? There are definitely gray zones, and Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu worked hard to cross-cut these, you know, historical polarized identities. He talked about, you know, what he termed helalleşme. Helalleşme in Turkish, you know, would be translated as coming terms with the past, in a way that he approved that, yes, the secular Turkish state did some mistakes in the past, especially in the 1990s, with regards to pious Muslim communities, especially with regards to the headscarf issue, the exclusion of headscarf from the public space. He also, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, signaled to the Kurds that, yes, the secular Turkish state excluded the Kurds in the past. He also openly uttered his Alevi identity, right? He really signaled that, you know, Turkey should become a more plural, more democratic society, rather than, you know, boxing Turkey into these, you know, secular versus Muslim identities. But Erdogan definitely used, for instance, this anti-LGBT discourse, right? That he was really playing to consolidate these pious Muslim communities in Turkey, that, you know, if the opposition comes to power, the family values, the religious values would be, you know, declined. So that anti-LGBT discourse was definitely a plan, a narrative that aimed to consolidate the pious Muslim communities, which many feel uncomfortable about, the broadly speaking, this Western secular identity. But again, I don't want to just reduce everything to this secular versus religious identities. But you are right, it definitely plays a significant role. On the other hand, I mean, Erdogan, definitely he plays the Islamist card, but he also projects himself as part of the, in a way, the Western world, because Turkey is a member of NATO, and it is not easy to detach Turkey from that, you know, historical background of Turkish governments, Turkish military, from the NATO camp. And in Turkey, you know, pro-Russian, pro-Soviet emotions were never strong in terms of the government, right? In terms of government policies, Turkey since the 1950s, since the Cold War, has always been on the Western camp. But these days, definitely in the last decade or so, Erdogan definitely built what I call a Turkish military industrial complex. The defense industry in Turkey, if you follow closely, these, you know, the drone technology, the broad defense industry really helped Erdogan to project an image that Turkey is a rising power in world politics. Turkey plays a greater role in world politics in different regions. I mean, look at the Karabakh conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia. Turkish drones played a role in Ukraine. Turkish drones, you know, played a role. Now they are selling drones to Middle East, Africa. So there's definitely this image that Turkey is a rising power. So that also appealed to some secular nationalist circles to support Erdogan rather than the opposition. So I'm not reducing everything to religious versus secular divide, but you are correct, that plays kind of a, there has always been a culture wars. I mean, look at Hagia Sophia, right? Erdogan turned it into a mosque again. It used to be a museum. It was turned into a museum under the secular Republican regime, and even turning Hagia Sophia into a mosque was a boost for this neo-Ottoman, this pro-Islamist image of Erdogan and the Turkish government. This definitely appealed to the conservative pious circles, but again, also many secular national circles also supported Erdogan because of this, you know, Turkish military industrial complex, that Turkey is a rising power. Turkey has autonomous power. Turkey doesn't necessarily need the United States or NATO. Turkey is an individually autonomous rising power in this multipolar world. So this definitely appeals to the secular nationalist circles as well.
When we come back, what are the foreign policy implications for the re-election of Erdogan? Will Turkey become even more interventionist in the region? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Does Erdogan's re-election as Turkey's president suggest that Turkish democracy has eroded? Can competition in its elections survive? And what does it mean for regional politics and for Turkey as a regional power? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our panel today is Serhan Al, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at İzmir University of Economics in Turkey, and Hamut Salih, professor of political science and associate dean of international education at California State University Dominguez Hills. He is a regular commentator for Arab media and is a host of SWANA Region Radio. Mohamed Salih, I want to turn to you on this because I know in the West there has been criticism of Turkey's interventions in conflicts. Before the break, Serhan Al had talked about the impact of the drones, the impact of weaponry that Turkey has provided. I mean, one area, and we've talked about this quite a bit on the show, has been Turkey's role in Azerbaijan and its conflict with Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh. Of course, Ukraine was referenced in other conflicts within the region. Is this election a signal that those types of interventions are likely to increase because it's elevating Turkey's position as a, certainly a regional power, if not even, you know, growing even potentially as a more global power?
Just briefly, what Dr. Serhan said is all good, but I have one sort of difference. We should not deny, or I cannot deny the fact, at least from my perspective, that Erdogan is an Islamist. He makes sure that he uses Islam for his own benefits. And, you know, his wife wears a scarf and his advocate of all Islamism. But the form that he projects is a pacifist form, meaning that the combination of modern and traditional, and he has succeeded in establishing that fact. His coalition, on the other hand, is not Islamist. You cannot, I mean, it will be difficult to make a case that because the Kurdish Huda Party has its connection to Hezbollah, has the ideology of Hezbollah. Most Kurds are Sunnis, more than anything else. When you look at the coalition that he established, it's a united coalition. It's been in place for quite some time. I mean, the nationalists, he's aligned with them since the last parliamentarian election. So you have a history there. And it's used to challenge, strategically used to create a problem or a fragmentation with the opposition that Kemal had. The Kurds, for example, are represented in, it's a small number of them. They are not that influential. But the left party, which is Kurdish, it's a name that changed from the original PKK, or long story there. So they are Kurdish. So you have that. The nationalists against the nationalists. I think the point that I'm trying to convey is that it could be one way of looking at it is a distinction between Erdogan's beliefs and the coalition he's established. He was very pragmatic and a strategist. And again, the point I said, for all the reasons that Dr. Serhan mentioned, the opposition did not have an alternative. They did not take the next step. We are better, we have a stronger leader, we have an economy. So now to go back to your question, Douglas, in terms of, is there a fear, what's gonna happen, more interventionism, all of that. I think the biggest challenge for Erdogan is also external. How would the United States so far has said all the right thing, that they respect the election results and so on and so forth. How does the West look at Erdogan's win? Because he certainly emerged, you know, as a winner. But remember, 2016, he had the attempted coup. He has people in jail and they've been in jail for so many years now. Remembers also the opposition leader, the main leader that actually he was really challenging him. He was not allowed to run. There are serious challenges on the external, on the ground level. And then despite the fact that he has a strong support in foreign countries, particularly in Germany and other areas where he won in the first round, the expatriates in Europe, he doesn't have that support outside Europe and outside some areas in Europe. So the challenge now for how does the West look at Erdogan? Do they look at him as a person who now has the credibility and the strength to help us resolve the challenges? You know, he proved to be a good leader in terms of, you know, playing the mediator with the Russians. The grain issue. He has established good relationship with Putin and all of that. But he also has a plan for how to resolve this. And that could be one way of looking at it. The addition to that is, if the West looks at Erdogan as a problem, there are plenty of issues that he could address him. Dr. Serhan talked about Azerbaijan, all these conflict areas. The refugees could be a huge issue. The solution of the conflict in Syria, you could create a huge problem for Turkey on its borders with implication inside that could weaken Erdogan or at least make him authoritarian internally, more authoritarian, which may create some problems. But in terms of the region, in terms of looking at Erdogan, they see him as more of an ally than an enemy at this point. Erdogan has been very successful in talking about mutual gains. In other words, he's looking at regional politics from that interdependent liberal perspective, where we are all this together, we are interdependent, we are going to win all something. So he has established good relationship with the Gulf countries. A specific point there that should be taken into account. Dr. Serhon talked about the military industry that is developing, the drones, all of that. What the Turks are offering is actually for the Gulf states to invest and to become partners in the production of military armaments and so on and so forth. Because the challenge for him, you have established with this sophisticated industry, drone, tanks, all of that, you have to produce it. So he's bringing the Gulf countries to help him as partner in the production of military. That's not done before. The Emiratis will welcome that because what they do, they buy weapons. They are not part of it. So the military has that. Economically, has now a better relationship with Saudi Arabia that we have not seen. Relationship with Egypt is also getting better. Now, there are areas of conflict. In Libya, Turkey was a difference maker, and it was because the Turkish support to the group that was losing at the time against the other group, the balance of power in Turkey is now stable because of the support for the government-led sort of association of the Libyan. So they're seen as a positive contribution. In addition, he has strong relations with most Northern African countries, in particular with Algeria. These are particularly important players in the region. His position on the Palestinian issue is also very respected. So I don't see him as becoming more interventionist, because the biggest problem for Erdogan at this point is economics. The lira currency is going down. And there are no revenues. He is reaching out to the Saudis, to the ISIL countries for contribution. Will these countries deliver? So far, it's been treaties after treaties. He has alliances with Iran. He's using a lot of things. But that lira thing, that economy, is the biggest difference. And the challenge for him is no longer in the polls, is internally civil movements, the Kurdish issue, people talking about personal liberties. These are the challenges that you are. And Dr. Serhoud knows very well. I mean, Turkey's, if you are in a city like Istanbul, everybody talks about everything except politics. I mean, you get in a car. I mean, if you get a Kurdish in a cab, yes, you may talk some really very, if they know you, they will talk to you about politics, but it's cultural and all that stuff and how great the flag is, all of that stuff. It's a serious, serious, serious point. Now, is this different from other part of the Arab world? It's the same place. I mean, all in the Gulf countries, I mean, it's all a pattern. So the point is this, is what kind of challenges that would force Erdogan to be an interventionist is what we need to look at. Will the crisis internally drive him to go to Libya and be more of a military, involved in a military? Will the drone lead to establish of, what United States is doing in some African countries, build drone or military bases all by drone and things like that? So it's very challenging, but I don't see him, at least in the short term, to be interventionist. I think he will be very, very pragmatic, and he will see to play a very instrumental role in the current crisis in the Ukraine.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the Turkish election, the re-election of President Erdogan, with Serhan Al of the İzmir University of Economics in Turkey, and Hamut Sali of California State University, Dominguez Hills. Now, Serhan, one question that keeps coming up, certainly here in the West, is what this re-election means for democracy in Turkey. Now, in your first, in your initial thoughts, you suggested Turkey wasn't really a democracy anyway. Turkey is a contested authoritarian state. And that Erdogan's victory is owed at least in part to the fact that it is not really a democracy, or at least that the government has tremendous levers of power that they're able to use, including choosing not to count certain votes, it looks like, and outlawing certain political opposition from running against him, et cetera. Does this election signal, especially the success of using these undemocratic tactics,
Does this signal that whatever democracy is in Turkey is going down in even greater backsliding? Or do you expect kind of business as usual and that it isn't really democratic? It's certainly not going to become more democratic, but concerns about it becoming less democratic are a little bit overblown.
Well, I mean, it's definitely not good news for democracy, right, in general. Not just for Turkey, but a lot of people were expecting that, you know, if the opposition could win in Turkey, this would be a good news for other, you know, democratic struggles around the world against, you know, more authoritarian leaders. But on the other hand, would Turkey become Venezuela? Would Turkey become Russia? You know, this, in a way, Putinization of Erdogan. I am not sure. If you look at the recent cabinet, his cabinet, it seems some moderate, you know, members, Mehmet Şimşek, for instance, who is in charge of the economy right now, he is mostly an orthodox, mostly peaceful with the international financial institutions, well-respected in those circles as well. So we don't know, but definitely Turkey in the last decade declined significantly. If you look at the Freedom House or the Democracy Index by the Economist Intelligence Unit, if you look at the VDEM Institute, I mean, there's certainly a shared agreement that Turkey is not a, you know, it used to be electoral democracy, I would put it that way, that, you know, somehow there were, you know, free and fair elections. But remember, there has been significant military interventions in the past, throughout the 20th century in Turkey. The Kurds were definitely marginalized in Turkey, even before Erdogan, right? So that's why I said that Turkey was never an ideal democracy, right? And Erdogan definitely didn't, in the sense that, you know, that Turkey is still not a democracy. But what we see is that one thing is unprecedented, that if you look at the century of Turkey, Erdogan has been the leader who's been in power more than anyone else, more than even Atatürk, right? More than even some of the Ottoman sultans. So definitely we see a trend of personalization of the state, where the independence of many state institutions, where the independence of judiciary are definitely not, at least where we can't, not present anymore. So definitely Erdogan is identified as the state, right? So, and this is kind of an alarming situation in terms of the idea of modern state. The idea of modern state is an impersonal state with independent, you know, institutions. So we definitely see a significant backsliding from there. But on the other hand, I mean, if anyone wants to read the elections from a more positive perspective, the opposition is not weak, right? It's 52% for Erdogan, 48% for the opposition, and many in the opposition definitely desire a more democratic state with respect to human rights, with respect to individual rights, kind of a more liberal society rather than this, you know, conservative society. So definitely there's hope out there. But also in general, the fabric of Turkey, traditional, the political culture, they are, you know, at least the ballots are important, right? And if you look at the voter turnout in Turkey, it has always been high, compared to Europe, compared definitely to the United States in this recent
election. And by the way, if I can quickly follow up then there as well, because we've had this focus on the election, but is this election, is it likely or possible at least that it really is going to open up civil society's ability to try to challenge Erdogan's rule, or is it basically the opposition's major option here is organize for the next election? Are there going to be avenues by which there could be levels of resistance from civil society for those who support the opposition?
Definitely, but with very limited opportunities, right? Definitely civil society, I mean, traditionally has been somewhat, you know, strong in Turkey, especially since the 1990s. That's also one of the successes of Erdogan. If you look at the political Islam in Turkey, it really grew out of the streets from grassroots movements that, you know, stopping by every door in the neighborhoods, getting in touch with women, getting in touch with youth. So Erdogan definitely comes from a social movement. His party definitely, you know, at least a couple of decades ago, I'm considering Erdogan comes from the welfare party in the 1980s, in the 1990s. It comes from a social movement tradition rather than a, you know, traditional political party. So it has been a bottom-up movement. But in the last couple of years, definitely Erdogan has become a, or his government become a, you know, a close circle of some, you know, oligarchic communities, business circles, or security, democracy, etc. But traditionally, it's a bottom-up movement. So it helped them a lot. They have a lot of experience in the grassroots. The opposition, on the other hand, which a lot of scholars point out, that they could not really reach out to the people. For instance, in central Anatolia, in eastern Turkey, they also say that, for instance, the security of the ballots during the elections was important, right? The opposition, in a way, failed to protect the ballots as well, especially outside of the major cities, Istanbul, Ankara, Izmir. So opposition definitely failed in that regard. So from now on, you know, the struggle would definitely start from the grassroots level. I mean, from all over Turkey, not just in major cities that the opposition feels strong, but in all over Turkey, which is not an easy task and which you can't do in a year or so. There needs to be a long tradition of that. Kurds, the Kurdish movement is very successful of doing that, despite that, you know, they lost some blood in the recent elections. They come from this grassroots mobilization, right? They come from a social movement tradition. So what the opposition can do is definitely benefit from the Kurdish experience of mobilizing the people, mobilizing the grassroots, keeping the civil society alive and vital, right? So definitely the Kurdish movement has a great potential to teach the Turkish opposition about how to mobilize people against a more authoritarian Turkey. So there's definitely room for opportunity over there. But again, we are talking about the government, Erdogan is in power more than 20 years. So he has all the security networks, the police, the media, the judiciary. So it's definitely going to be a challenging task.
Definitely going to be, a huge check. Ahmed Salih, we have about 2 minutes left. I'm going to give you the last word about, do you see any signs for optimism in Turkey?
It's a matter of seeing half full, half empty cup. I certainly don't share the optimism that Dr. Serhan has in terms of the opposition ability. I think the opposition in Turkey lost touch like many other parts of the world. Turkey is not advancing any Western values or anything. What we see is a strengthening of Erdogan's power through the political party. You'll have more authoritarianism, and that will be at the expense of many other issues. The Kurdish issue, I think on a national level, has been sort of under control by the idea of Putin, for example, this whole emphasis on terrorism and terrorist organization, even Putin applying it at the local, at the mayor's level. That's an issue that was during this election. The advancement that the Kurds get under Erdogan could be used to make the argument that, you know, they're better, you know, under his regime, the Turks have the right to learn their language, to assemble, and they are split. You know, that's what he's doing. We tend to forget that Erdogan made Turkey global. Until this election, Turkey was a global power. The Germans used to come to Turkey to find jobs. So there are so many things you have to look at. But it remains to be, I would say, more of a de Gaullean state than Atatürk. You know, his shift to change into a presidential system indicate that power. And it's very, very interesting is that in this vote, Erdogan's party won the majority of the parliament. And that sort of will tells you how deep is the Turkish or the Erdogan state and rooted in the Turkish society. But it is not about westernization, women issue or something. It's really the basic civil liberties issues, freedom of the press and all of those are the issues that will sort of cut him. His power, he is full control. He's the one actually who got rid of the army, who's been able to give more power to the military. The court is under his leadership. So he has an upper hand. Will he be successful? Can you rule the country and with authoritarian forever? That's a challenge that I don't think Erdogan can do. But, you know, the other thing is that this is his second term. Will he find another Putinian kind of system to keep himself after the second term? Because the constitution allows him only two terms. It's limited. So that's really some of the things we watch. But it's very interesting. This is a very, very good piece for scholars. It adds to more confusion on my end than understanding it. Really, yeah.
Thank you both very much for joining us and sharing your insights. Our panel today has been Serhan Al, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at İzmir University of Economics in Turkey. He's the author of An Anatomy of Nationhood and the Question of Assimilation, Debates on Turkishness Revisited, Human Security versus National Security, Kurds, Turkey, and Syrian Rojava, and Is Turkey Ready for the Post-Erdogan Era? Roadblocks to a Democratic Transition. And Hamut Salih, professor of political science and the associate dean of international education at California State University, Dominguez Hills. He's a regular commentator for Arab media and is a host of SWANA Region Radio.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankine Agasyan and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.